This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for the Week in Review. And we'll start with the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. Just this past hour, Los Angeles FBI Assistant Director David Bowditch announced a major change in the investigation.
As of today, based on the information and the facts as we know them, we are now investigating these horrific acts as an act of terrorism.
Two suspects, Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, killed 14 people and wounded 21 others on Wednesday. Law enforcement officials are now saying that Malik had pledged allegiance to ISIS in a Facebook post. Also at the White House today, Press Secretary Josh Earnest wouldn't confirm the reports of Malik's ISIS pledge, but he did say that the White House hopes the response to the attacks will be a positive one, comparing it to what happened after the Boston Marathon bombing.
And the response that we saw from the citizens of Boston was absolutely inspiring. This appeal to the notion of being Boston strong, and that just days after this terrible attack was carried out at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, tens of thousands of Bostonians turned out at Fenway Park for a baseball game. That's the kind of response and spirit and patriotism that the American people have shown in the face of this threat.
Joining us now to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is Richard Tessay, former Republican minority leader in the Massachusetts State Senate. Richard, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Also with us today is Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Shira, good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
So your first thoughts on this latest development in the San Bernardino mass shooting, that now officials are treating it as an act of terrorism. And Richard, let's start with you.
Well, I'd say it's about time, you know, watching. I understand you can't rush to judgment, but I think it's become pretty evident here from the beginning what actually happened there. And I know that some people were trying to make this about gun control and other people were trying to make it about workplace violence. But at the end of the day, you know, the evidence is out there and what a lot of people have suspected from the beginning, you know, it is what it is. And that's radical Islamic terrorism. And, you know, so the FBI has come out now and said that it's terrorism. We just got to get to the to the motive. And I think, you know, that's in the next couple of days, you're going to see that confirmed as well, too. And, I think it's important if we're going to deal with this, and I think everything has changed right now. This is the new normal, unfortunately, here in the United States. And in order to be able to deal with it, we're going to have to understand what it is and put together a plan to deal with it. But we got to face it first.
Shira, your thoughts?
Well, I'd say, yes, it is terrorism, but it's also still a mass shooting. And I still think gun control should be on the table. I mean, listen, this is now not just weekly, not just monthly, but we are hearing, you know, it was, 5 days between mass shootings? So something, I think, needs to be done with gun control. I know we get blue in the face saying this after every mass shooting, but the statistics show, and they're showing the same statistics on the news today, that if you take guns out of circulation, you decrease the probability of a mass shooting.
So this is actually some place where, sorry, Richard, I didn't mean to jump in, but this is a place where the debate over gun control and terrorism definitely sharply intersect, because I was also reading a lot of people saying, including California Senator Barbara Boxer this week, that, you know, airlines can keep people off airplanes because they're on the no-fly list, but those same people can still buy AR-15s like were used in California.
They had an IED factory in their home. I mean, you know, so if they weren't going to use guns, they would have used all the bombs that they were making in the home. So I don't think that, you know, I think that what's happened right now, this is different, you know, than what we've been becoming, unfortunately, accustomed to with these shootings. This is totally different. These people, it isn't a crackpot out, shooting people. These are people who, have a very specific goal, and that is to, you know, create as much fear and terrorism and eventually try to bring down, you know, the Western civilization. And it's a lot more than, I think, you know, what we've become accustomed to.
See, and I don't think it's different in this sense. For the reasons you brought up, Meghna, we have terrorists on watch lists. They are on no-fly lists. Why can we not pass legislation? I believe yesterday they failed to pass legislation barring people who are on terrorist watch lists from getting guns. I mean, it seems like that would be a no-brainer and a first step. And you know, you talk about this intersection here. That's where it intersects. Right. I understand the point about the IEDs. We'll also ignore the point that many of the bombs that they had manufactured were non-functional and couldn't have gone off the way
their
they were
structured. Their intent is pretty obvious.
Exactly.
Though.
Their intent was obvious. But why can't we take a obvious first step and take away the ability of people who have terrorist tendencies, terrorist inclinations, to purchase guns and to have in their possession semi-automatic rifles?
Well, and including thousands of rounds of ammunition.
Exactly.
As well. I mean, I think they said that, you know, they fired around more than 70 rounds, but they had, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 rounds both in their car and more at the home.
There's no question at all about that. And I think, but I think if you extrapolate it a little further, you know, the real debate's going to become, in the age that we're living in right now, do you disarm the public? And you know, a lot of people are out there right now, including the sheriff in New York, who happens to be a Democrat, who ended up saying, you know, who's encouraging people in his county to carry weapons with them as a way to prevent or at least, you know, lessen the carnage from
this. Okay, so I'm curious about this, Richard, because I'm pretty sure I remember correctly that California actually has an open carry law in existence already.
California has...
It didn't make any difference. Right,
exactly.
But they have an open carry law.
Well, I guess
no one stopped them.
Well, I guess, but I would say California has the most, you know, some of the toughest gun laws in the entire country, and that didn't. If you know you're a terrorist and you're intent on killing as many innocent people as you can, it doesn't matter whether you use a pressure cooker like the, you know, the Zanaroff brothers did here in Boston, or have all these bombs built, which we just saw in California, or who knows how else they're going to try to do it. You know, and this is what we have to deal with.
Shira, do you want to jump in here?
Well, I would just say that, you know, the same intensity of intent can be had by somebody who perhaps is mentally ill, who has access to guns and perhaps also explosive devices. I mean, I think this is, you know, to limit this to a discussion on terrorism, I think is inappropriate. And I just hope that because there is this terrorist link, we don't forget the gun control portion of this issue.
Yeah, and here's the thing that I obviously, so what we saw this week in San Bernardino, there's also the Planned Parenthood shooting in Colorado last week, you know, a shooting nonetheless, depending on your political persuasion, some people are calling that domestic terrorism. But then there's also Paris as well, where both guns and bombs were used, right? Because they had explosive vests, some of the terrorists there. So, I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that we are now in a world where the new normal, in your phrase, Richard, is that it's not just going to be either guns or bombs. It's going to be both. So you know, how do you deal with that?
As soon as I saw it on TV, you know, I watched Paris. I watched what happened there. But when this happened, I said, you know what? The United States is never going to be the same again, because it's so easy for people to go out and do what was done in California at any shopping mall anywhere around the United States to inflict that type of damage if you're an evil person. And, you know, and you know, these people with 6-month-year-old child who gave up their child to go to paradise. You know, this is what the mindset of what we're dealing with right now.
There's a terrible irony in that, I have to say. And I'm just speaking as a parent, that apparently these two individuals, we don't yet know their motivation, but let's presume that if this allegiance to ISIS is true, that they possessed some profound enmity towards the United States, enough to take the lives of 14 people and wound more than 20 others grievously. But their child, they still want her to be, or him, I'm not sure, to be raised in this same country. I mean, it's just, I can't, there's no logic in my head that makes that work for me.
Yeah, no, I don't think there is any logic that can make it work. I mean, you're talking about a family that, by all descriptions I've heard, were living the quote-unquote American dream.
Yeah.
You know, he was employed with a good job. They just had a child 6 months ago, as you say. And I think one of the other consequences of this is we're going to have to really re-examine how we figure out who potential terrorists are and think about what we're doing to figure out, because this family does not fit the profile in any way, shape, or form that, or at least it was not on the radar of any of the security folks when they were looking at potential terrorists.
Right, because Syed Farouk was 28, a U.S.-born citizen, born
exactly.
in Illinois.
I would just say they do fit the profile now that we know. I mean, they didn't show up on a list, but, you know, they're both Muslim. He went to Saudi Arabia a couple of times. You know, anybody who goes to Saudi Arabia for vacation right now, I would probably put on a list and at least watch
them.
That's
a very broad swath of people.
I understand,
yeah.
But...
I mean, I've just talked to a woman who went to Saudi Arabia. She's an Olympic athlete for Saudi Arabia and lives in the United
but
States.
But, I mean, you should probably at least look at them if you're going on vacation to Saudi Arabia and you're becoming, you know... There should be certain triggers.
The Islamic world is vast, though. I mean, are we going to look at everyone who's gone to Indonesia, who's gone to Malaysia, who's got...
No, because there hasn't been cases where those people...
They're Muslim there, too.
Yeah, but they're not blowing up people.
And there have been terrorist incidents there, too.
Yeah, but not... It isn't Chinese people. It isn't Australians. It isn't Austrians or Germans. You know, that's a hot spot in the world right now that I think people who are traveling to the Middle East, Syria or Iraq or Saudi Arabia or any
Israel,
of those
places. I mean, where are you going to stop
well,
here?
So let me just offer a piece of tape here. Because
I feel like Donald Trump here.
but you're offering a viewpoint that obviously a lot of people have, so much so that very prominent members of the Muslim community have felt compelled to speak on it just this week, because we have some tape that aired on NPR's Morning Edition with Steve Inskeep. He spoke with Hussan Elouche, who's the executive director on the Council on American Islamic Relations in Los Angeles. And here is what Elouche said.
I'll be very frank with you. You know, every time there's a shooting, whether it's Colorado Springs or here, there's the first feeling is the feeling of sorrow, feeling of insecurity. We worry about our family members, our kids, our neighbors. But also there's always the concern that what if that shooter is someone who claims to be Muslim, and then we'll have to deal with this another new wave of Islamophobia, because there are those in our country who exploit these tragic events in order to promote hatred and bigotry against Islam and Muslims.
So, Richard, I'm going to give you the first chance to respond to that.
But of everything that's happened here in the United States and across the world, you don't see Buddhists doing this. You don't see Hindus doing this. You don't see Jews doing this, or Christians. There's a radicalized group of Islamists who are doing it. So, yeah, if you were going to dig back to what I was saying earlier, I mean, they're not coming from Israel. The Israeli citizens...
But Timothy McVeigh wasn't a Muslim.
Israeli citizens aren't coming here and blowing people up. And so, and what I was saying is, I mean, that does...
I wasn't talking about Israeli citizens. I was talking about, you know, when you say you're going to have to look at people who are going to the Middle East. I was saying simply Israel is part of the Middle East. Well, the Middle East is vast. The Muslim world is vast. And there are a lot of places that you're just... You know, painting with...
No, I'm saying the Middle East, and I would look at all the males between 20 and 28 years old, because, you know, you can't...
Now you have to look at the females,
too. Now you have to look at the females,
and now you have to also look at mothers.
Well, so this is obviously, I mean, I have to say I really appreciate this conversation, because this is exactly the thinking that we all have to engage in right now, everywhere from this table to Washington, D.C., right, where these kind of decisions are going to be made. If it's okay with you, there was other news in the world this week, and I would like to turn to it. And you know, sadly, this news about terrorism and shooting, et cetera, is not going to go away. So I'm sure we'll have another chance in a future week to discuss it. But let's turn now, if we can, to Harvard University and issues of race on college campuses. Lots of stuff going on at Harvard specifically this week. We had the announcement of a committee to take a look at the use of the Royal Coat of Arms on the Harvard Law School shield. And we have some tape here and the Royals, by the way, being a 18th century Massachusetts family, a slaveholding family. Their money helped found Harvard Law School. So we have some tape here from A.J. Claiborne, a HLS law student or Harvard law student who's part of a group called Royal Must Fall. Let's listen.
To me, the seal symbolizes a slave owner, a man whose family was involved in the brutal torture and murder of 88 slaves in Antigua, and who sold slaves frequently up here in New England, including to the governor of Boston.
Okay, but not all students want to change the seal. Here's a different perspective from Jane Jung, another Harvard Law student.
You know, how far back do you have to go? I mean, it's just you can't impose the standards of today on all of history in that sense. I think the American history, a large part, was based on a lot of discrimination, which is very unfortunate. What is, like, the natural endpoint to that? Like, do you also go back to, like, Washington, D.C., for instance, and rename everything that's Washington, because our founding fathers were, I mean, to be forward, they were racist. It was just a different time back then.
Okay, so Shira, you're up first. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the second speaker has a very good point, which is just how far back do you go? And while I understand the objections of Harvard Law students to the Royal Seal, I mean, you can look a lot of places on the Harvard campus and find examples of perhaps names or symbols or seals that should come down. One that came immediately to mind when I was hearing about this is Lowell House, which is the undergraduate house named after Abbot Lawrence Lowell. He wanted to have quotas for Jewish students. He kicked black students out of Harvard Yard in 1922, and he was part of the secret court that basically tried to get rid of homosexuals at Harvard. So, you know, there's a lot wrong with President Lowell and Lowell House. You can look there, and I'm sure there are plenty of more examples at Harvard University that you can look at. So I sort of fall into the how far are we going to go back? When does this stop side of the argument.
So, Richard, do you agree? I mean, the implication there is that you can't erase an institution's history.
Yeah, and I agree. You know, and this is symbolic of what we were talking about earlier, because people won't call what's happening, you know, as far as terrorism, what it is. And in this case, you have everybody who's so super sensitive. You have a whole generation of kids who are in college right now who are just looking for ways to feel like they were victimized. They're victims, you know. They're going to Harvard, one of the best schools, one of the most exclusive schools, you know, in the entire country. And you would think that they would have better things to be doing, you know, better causes to be pushing for, than trying to erase something that happened 150 years.
Okay, so let me provide pushback to both of you on this. So there's the criticism that it maybe it's like you're trying to erase an institution's history. But I think what the point the student activists are making is it's not so much erasing, but a reckoning of the true scope of what these names actually symbolize. Because what you learn when you take the tour of Harvard, you don't learn any of these things about Lowell. You don't learn any of these things about the royal family. So this is forcing an acknowledgement that the history is more complicated than we usually give credit for.
It's gone too far, though. I mean, this whole changing the name of the master, you know, the person who...
Oh, that house masters are not allowed to be called masters anymore, right? In the residence.
Because that constitutes slavery. But that isn't how that's a British term that's been around for a long time, and it means headmaster or schoolmaster. But because, you know, it sounds like, oh, somebody's feelings are going to get hurt, they have to change that, and it's ridiculous. I mean, I think this is going to become an episode of South Park. Watch, because South Park has been on top of this, over political correctness.
Go ahead, Jared.
And I agree with what you're saying in terms, you know, of it's important to have a reckoning about this. But just to take the housemaster example, for one, you know, they want to have a name, I think, that's more aligned with 21st century residential student life needs. That's great.
But you go to Harvard for tradition in part.
One, but also let's put the focus on the residential student needs. Let's put not the focus on the name, but actually on what the house masters or whatever they're going to be called, what they're doing, if they're doing their job, if they're fostering community in the undergraduate houses. Because I know that it's not always the case, that they are oftentimes absentee from their own houses. So let's focus on the job they're doing and not so much on the title that they have.
They should be calling them babysitters
rather than
masters.
And, hearing people tapping on the keyboard furiously already, sending me emails saying that is wrong.
But if you take that example a little further, you know, the White House is called the White House. So somebody could be offended because...
It's white. And it's a house.
Yeah, but... Exactly. But it could be...
Okay, so let me ask you this. Let me ask both of you this.
Marginalizing minorities.
Harvard students are, like, you know, this is also happening at Yale, it's happening at Princeton, it's happening on many college campuses. On the one hand, yes, it's easy for us outside the college campus to say, you know, you got better things to do. But on the other hand, there's something about university life. Like, this is the time for people to test out their advocacy. And if it's going to be on things that we externally think are small... Who cares? I mean, they're also forming leadership skills and advocacy skills that they'll take off campus when they graduate.
I would say yes to that, but I think there also has to be a limit. And one of the things I read this week was, I think it was the Oklahoma Wesleyan University president. He posted something on his school's website because he had heard about a student objecting to a sermon on love. And why did the student object to the sermon on love? Because he felt he was not putting out enough love, and he felt criticized by this sermon, and he complained because that sermon about love made him feel uncomfortable. And the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, an evangelical Christian university, which I never thought I'd be on the same side of, was basically saying that, you know, students today have become very narcissistic, and you're not going to college to be in a safe place. place. You're going into college as a place to learn and to learn about others. And I think somehow that message has been lost. And I'm glad that this college president stood up for that.
Hang on, Richard, for just a second, because there's one last piece of tape on this subject that I want to get in here on our Week in Review, because it's from an interview that elicited a lot of response that we aired this week. And it was from Professor Randall Kennedy. He's a Harvard Law School professor. And he basically told us that he sympathizes a great deal with many of the student activists that he's encountering at Harvard right now, but that some of them have also, in his words, pushed him away. And he urged student activists to really take after examples of what he called the great champions of black advancement from the civil rights movement. And here's what he meant.
They proceeded with a dignity that was just absolutely unassailable. You take a look at the early SNCC demonstrators, the people who sat in. They did not talk about being traumatized. They did not ask for anything but simple justice. They carried on in a spirit that I think today's dissidents should look at, and they should model themselves after dissident forebears who really showed what carrying on a struggle is all about.
Richard?
Hear, hear. That's said very, very well. And, you know, I do think, again, that a lot of this has happened is because we've had a whole generation grow up, with in an era where everybody's a victim and everybody's victimized. And, you know, you can't be that delicate. You have to... You know, what started Yale was that, I guess, one of the masters sent out a note, you know, regarding Halloween costumes.
There was a discussion about whether certain Halloween costumes would be appropriate or not.
I mean, you know, honestly, in this day and age, these kids have better things to do with.
So we are fresh out of time. I mean, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the Blue Hill Deer Hunt.
And all this stuff prepared on deer contraception.
Okay, library. What a week. Okay, well, but I do want to, we've got just 2 minutes left here. So briefly, I like the hubbub. So let's see if we can get to them this week. And Shira, let's start with you. Your hubbub.
Well, many in New England, I'm sure, are mourning after the Patriots' first loss of the season and the end of their bid for a perfect season. So, as a public service announcement, I'm going to give everybody a new undefeated team to root for.
Oh, okay.
And this is a team with record-breaking players, history-making players. It is the BC Women's Ice Hockey Team.
Oh, great.
They are 17-0, ranked number 2 in the country behind number 1 Wisconsin. There are former Olympians, future Olympians on this team. It is a great ice hockey team that plays a great brand of ice hockey. If you want to root for another undefeated team, if you want to jump on a bandwagon, it's right down the road at BC.
All right, here, here for BC. We got to get them on the show. Okay. And Richard, you're...
For those who have been watching the very bitter battle that's been taking place between casino developer Steve Wynn and Mayor Marty Walsh, there was a huge development today when a Superior Court judge dismissed a lawsuit filed by the mayor to try to stop Wynn from building the casino in Everett. The judge's decision amounted to pretty much a straight flush for Wynn, as the judge dismissed all 10 counts brought by the city. It was an odd case, though, from the start, and the city never really had a winning hand, as Walsh was claiming that the city of Boston was should be a host community, even though the casino was being built in another city. And the complaint that was filed was filled with all kinds of innuendo against the Gaming Commission, which the judge made it a point to call out the city for. Any way you look at it, it's a huge win for Wynn. And those who are looking forward to a local casino will soon have an Everett location. Finally, as for Boston, the mayor's already spent $1 million on legal fees on this, and there's no word yet on whether he's going to up the ante, double down, and appeal.
You get the award for most casino cliches in one thought. I love
good.
It. You're a winner today. My hubbub has to do with the news. I think it was just today. Yeah, just today. I want to give a shout out to Ronald Grimm at the Boston Public Library. He's the BPL's map curator, who noticed an image in a New York antiques dealer's summer catalog of a 1612 map by explorer Samuel de Champlain. He looked at the image carefully and remembered, hey, there was a very similar one taken from the BPL a long time ago. Turns out This is the map, and it has been returned to the Boston Public Library. It had been offered for sale for $285,000. It's a great sort of piece of news for the BPL, who needed it, based on the fact that, you know, they had that tumult with other things walking out of the library.
Say, an interesting lost and found over there
before.
At the library.
So this one has been returned. Thanks to the sharp eyes of Ronald Grimm. We as citizens of Boston, thank you, Ronald. So that's my that's my hubbub for today. Richard Tessay, former Republican minority leader in the Massachusetts State Senate. Really great to have you on, Richard.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. And Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of The Globe. Really great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me again.
There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.